have health.
Eric, you good?
Yeah.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, February 14th. Happy, happy birthday, Oregon. 159th birthday of our wonderful state. Great to be here serving the state on our birthday. And, oh, it's some other holiday, too, that it must be because I see people wearing red. But if you celebrate that, cool. Have a great day. I am opening what?
We're not wearing red.
I'm not wearing red either.
All right.
Yeah. I am.
All right.
All right. On that note, I am opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be doing two informational hearings. The first from the Office of Public Defense Services on the Parent-Child Representation Program Overview, and then later on the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Public Guardian Program Update. Ms. Byerly.
Madam Co-Chair, I think that this informational item is coming before you because there had been some discussion in the fall about having this program come in and kind of give you an update on what they do and how they interact a little bit with the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program to kind of give you some context. This organization usually comes before the Public Safety Committee, so it's not usually something you see in your budget portfolio, but there are definitely connections, programmatic connections between this agency and DHS.
And I actually requested this because I serve on the Public Safety Subcommittee, so I hear about it there. And I'm delighted to have Ms. Miller and Mr. Borg here with us. So please, floor is
thank
yours.
Thank you. Chair Senator Hayward and Chair Rayfield, thank you for this opportunity, and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Lane Borg, and I am the new Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. I've been on the job for about 6 weeks, but prior to that, I ran Metropolitan Public Defenders for almost 10 years. That's the largest public defender's office in the state of Oregon and is the primary contractor in Multnomah and Washington counties. MPD does almost anything you can get a court-appointed lawyer for, and relevant to today's hearing, we do juvenile, both delinquency and dependency representation. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to present our parent-child representation program today, although, as was stated, we normally appear and will again next week appear before the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means. It's appropriate that we present this to you. Public defenders sit at the intersection of public safety, public health, education, and housing. That's because the clients that public defenders represent and serve use and touch all of those programs, and it's interrelated in terms of how they, where they're going to be. We used to call it the safety net, the public safety net. Now it's just their life and how they interrelate. And it's critical to have advocates that understand how their clients interrelate to social services and are adequately resourced, not just to seek the best plan, but also to not inadvertently put up a barrier to accessing those social services. The PCRP has already demonstrated promise in improving outcomes for children, families, and communities, and Amy Miller is going to give you a lot more detail. Thank you.
Good morning, happy holidays. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Rayfield, members of the committee, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak with you today about the work of attorneys who represent parents and children in juvenile dependency cases. My name is Amy Miller. I'm currently the acting deputy director at our agency, but my regular job is in the Office of General Counsel, where I focus primarily on the practice of juvenile law. And as you may know, parents and children in juvenile dependency court have a right to court-appointed counsel at state expense if they're financially eligible. The Office of Public Defense Services is charged with providing cost-effective legal representation that both meets constitutional requirements and is consistent with state and national standards. And that's our mandates, you know, dictated to us in statute. So my presentation today is going to be brief. I'm going to explain a little bit about the role of attorneys for parents and children, partially because I'm in a different committee than, and I'm going to take this opportunity to do a little bit of education and hopefully answer your questions about that. Describe the agency's challenges in meeting our statutory mandate, and then spend most of my time highlighting the PCRP, the program that I manage. Let's see if I can make this work. Okay. I think there's a perception of kind of the traditional defense attorney that they spend almost all of their time in the courtroom. They litigate everything that they can, and they, you know, aren't always looking to collaborate on case resolution. And certainly the juvenile court system includes litigation, but attorneys for parents and children have a much broader role than that. Juvenile attorneys are guided by detailed performance standards that are adopted by the Oregon State Bar and are regularly updated. And I just looked at them. They're 119 pages long and provide a whole lot of guidance about what we need to be doing in these cases. So the bubbles on this slide reflect the multifaceted work of the lawyers who represent parents and children. And I honestly could spend all day, and some of you know that I could spend all day talking about the work that lawyers do, but I'm going to settle for explaining just a couple of their roles in detail so you can get a better picture of that. Lawyers protect constitutional rights. The right to raise one's children has been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court as a fundamental liberty interest. And when the child welfare system intervenes with a family, that's a significant deprivation of parental rights. Lawyers enable effective judicial decision-making. So the decisions courts make in these cases are serious and change lives. Parents stand the possibility of permanently losing custody and contact with their children. Children and youth are subject to court decisions that may forever change their connection to their culture, their siblings, and their heritage. It is really essential that juvenile court judges have all the information that they need from all parties to make the right decision. Lawyers are counselors. Parents, in particular, are under substantial stress in the system. As you know, they may face mental health and addiction challenges, and really can be overwhelmed by the requirements imposed on them by the court. It's not a surprise that these parents become fatigued, they become disenchanted, and they wonder if their hard work will pay off. Lawyers motivate parents to stay engaged. Lawyers enhance child safety. The confidential attorney-client privilege allows children to feel safe sharing information with attorneys that may otherwise go unvoiced. And the child client's lawyer in particular should be advocating for actions necessary to meet the child's educational, health, cultural, and mental health needs. Lawyers ensure government accountability. The agency is required to make reasonable efforts to reunify families and in case planning, and they must comply with the law. And lawyers promote procedural justice. Research supports that when a party experiences a sense of fairness, he or she is more likely to comply with court orders, more likely to return to court for future hearings, more likely to trust in the system, and less likely to repeat offenses. Parents and children must have the sense of fairness and trust in court proceedings because in juvenile court, they need to buy into case planning. They need to buy into what the parties are trying to accomplish. So quality legal representation means that lawyers have time and are sufficiently trained to develop a relationship with clients, to adequately investigate cases, to actively participate in case planning, and to litigate issues when needed. Quality legal representation is not just what the families in our system deserve, it's also linked to a number of positive results, as you can see. So one of these results is parent engagement. And this is, again, critical because of the nature of these cases. And there have been a number of studies, but one out of Washington State. And what they found is that when parents are just slightly more engaged, that there's a 47% increase in the rate of reunification in these cases. So it's critical. And another study by the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges emphasizes the importance of early and active involvement in the child welfare system. And that study says that when families are more likely to be reunified when parents are involved from the very beginning of a case and when parents have lawyers who are involved from the very beginning of a case. Another result is positive outcomes. So there's at least 14 different states and probably more that have implemented programs aimed at improving representation of parents or children or both in juvenile court cases. And most, if not all of them, have documented improved outcomes at this point. So for example, in Manhattan and Queens, New York City, quality legal representation resulted in reduced foster care stays. In those programs in those two boroughs, children spend less than 1 month in foster care compared to the citywide average of 5.5 months. In Washington State, there's a parent representation program, and I'm going to talk about our program, but ours is sort of based on theirs. So in their parent representation program, they have been shown to increase reunifications by 36% through improved legal representation. And as a result of reduced foster care use, state governments are able to redirect your precious resources elsewhere. So there are a lot of opportunities, but our system is facing a number of challenges. And that really makes this quality legal representation difficult for us to achieve. First of all, our system doesn't incentivize good work. So in most of the state, we provide public defense services on a per-case basis. An attorney is paid a flat rate to handle the case, regardless of the work that is done the outcome of the case, how much time is spent on the case. And right now, the typical rate is $830, and that is 60, 90 days or longer, and can involve a trial, can involve a settlement, and it's for a lengthy period of time. Our systems are outdated. We don't know how many cases a lawyer is handling, and that itself is surprising, but we also don't know how many cases a lawyer should have, because we don't have Oregon-specific caseload standards. So we have no idea if lawyers can deliver a higher level of representation with 80 cases or 90 cases or 150 cases. We don't know. There have been a history of concerns about the quality of legal representation of parents and children in juvenile dependency cases, so dating back to 2000 and even before. But in 2000, the Oregon State Bar's Indigent Defense Task Force report found juvenile dependency representation severely lacking, noting that clients needing juvenile dependency representation faced an unreasonable likelihood of receiving poor representation. And since that time, we've had a number of audits and other reports with similar findings. And let me say, our agency has made a real concerted effort to respond to these concerns. So we've developed strong qualification standards for our teams. We have training obligations.
Can I have you hold up for just a moment, Ms. Miller, Representative Alonso Leon?
Thank you, Chair. Along the challenges here, I don't see anything related to equity and inclusion and language barriers. Do you guys have multilingual lawyers? Do you guys have a translation program? You know, those kinds of things. And I would assume they would be on this list.
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, Representative Alonso Leon, thank you for asking that question. This is sort of a higher level overview, and you were absolutely correct. We're gonna be talking a little bit more about our challenges next week in Public Safety Sub, and we will be talking about that particular issue. But as you know, there is pretty significant racial and ethnic disparities in the juvenile dependency system specifically. And one of the things that is a challenge for us, and I'll talk about it, is attracting and retaining attorneys. Certainly, your question about availability of interpreters and of language services, certainly we make sure that those are available. Culturally appropriate services and a diverse group of attorneys, that's a little more challenging and something that we need to work on. So I was also going to say that in terms of agency efforts to address some of these concerns, I coordinate a number of trainings for juvenile lawyers. We have these excellent performance standards that I was talking about, but we really lack the ability to do meaningful quality assurance. And we know, right, that in some places lawyers are working so hard and doing an excellent job, and I'm aware of those cases and those attorneys. And there are also places where that's not happening. Quality varies greatly across the state. And chronic underfunding has left us with high caseloads and difficulty finding lawyers willing to do this work. Court and agency practice really drive caseloads for us. And in particular, rapid changes are really hard for us to absorb because for the most part, our attorneys are on a 2-year contracting cycle. So it's very difficult to deal with ups and downs within that 2 period. But over the past couple of years, we've seen large increases in dependency cases. So for example, in Deschutes County, we saw a 30% increase between 2016 and 17. In Multnomah County, we saw a 25% increase between 2015 and 16. And what happens as a result is that some lawyers have alarmingly large caseloads. And in addition, it becomes a daily challenge for our office to find lawyers to cover these cases. So every week we get calls from courts saying that they need additional coverage. It takes our staff 5 phone calls, 10 phone calls, sometimes more, to get a lawyer to take on that case. And this is because for those coverage attorneys, we pay an hourly rate of $46, and we just can't incentivize them to take on more work at excessive caseloads at that rate. Best practice suggests that a caseload of 80 cases or less is appropriate, and yet lawyers in our system report 100 or more cases in addition to other types.
Ms. Miller, I could see caseload changing a lot if the state changes our laws, right, about what kinds of cases need to be reported or things like that. I could see it happening if the agency changed its rules, right? But if you're telling us that the caseload went up 25% in Multnomah County in 1 year and 30% in Deschutes County in a different year, I know that's not officially your bailiwick, but do you get any sense of what's going on there? Is it new agency people? Is it
Senator Steiner or Co-Chair Steiner Hayward. That's a good question. So I sit on the Juvenile Court Improvement Program Committee, and we talk about these issues all the time. And in particular, you know, right now, Southern Oregon is where the case driver is for much of the state. I think a lot of it is local practice, local staffing changes, needs of the community. I can tell you that in Linn County, for example, where I work very closely with the attorneys, you know, what I've noticed is the time it takes cases to close has been growing. And finally, I'm digging down into the root cause, and it's a housing issue. And so as things change in the counties, I think there are a ton of levers in the system, and it's really hard to get a handle on which pulls which lever. I think there's some additional probably research and discussion that needs to happen around those things. But I think for us, what we try to do is be as proactive as we can so that we're able to make sure, right, that we're able to manage this the best we can.
So I'm going to make an editorial comment, if I will. Two things. The first is, as you all can tell, Ms. Miller has enormous passion and expertise in this area. I've had the privilege of working with her now for several years, and I'm going to be blatant and say how much I admire the work that you do, because not only are you passionate about it, you dig deep. And that comment about the housing points out housing goes through transportation, economic development. Public defense services go through public safety. Child welfare comes through ARSA. For better or for worse, we can't have everything happen in every sub, but we need to understand to address these problems. I mean, if kids don't have a safe place to go home to, if they don't have stable housing, it's impossible for the state to legally reunify them with their families. And that's very problematic. So I think I asked this question partly because Ms. Miller and I have had this conversation before, but partly because I think it's important to really articulate clearly the interconnectedness of a lot of these issues. So I'm going to stop editorializing, but I think it's really important to point this out, because you cannot look at these issues in isolation. We can have the best legal representation system in the world, and if families don't have some place to call home that they can afford and where it's safe for children to be, it's not going to do us any good. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Miller was kind enough to set up a day for me to spend in court recently. Linn County is one of the pilot projects, and just building on what you talked about, every single case that came before the judge that day involved a housing issue, every single one. Now, should the kids have been reunited in every one of those? No, but that barrier was significant, as well as the issue of access to mental health services. And what was especially interesting to me, I think for those of us that aren't in the legal field, often you think of putting lots of attorneys in a room and having that be a very adversarial type of experience. Sorry, Co-Chair Rayfield. I'm not attempting to impugn you.
Adversarial for my wife every day she goes in and does this.
But to see in this particular case at the end, in which I believe the judge was speaking to all of us through me, that this lineup of attorneys, to have someone from the point of view of the child, to have someone from the point of view of the mother and the father and the court system and the foster parents and the CASA, really discussing this problem about this child that was being sent to Wyoming because we had no appropriate mental health services for him here, and there was a lack of housing for the parents. But it was not adversarial. Even though people took different positions, they were really collaborating, and I believe they all agreed that they want us to do more.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you. So, although our challenges are significant, the Parent-Child Representation Program addresses nearly all of them. So in 2014, the legislature funded the PCRP in response to some of this testimony and reports about deficiencies in the juvenile dependency representation. The legislature heard testimony from our counterparts in Washington State about a program that they've had in existence focused on improved legal representation for parents since 2000, and how that program improved quality and at the same time delivered cost-effective, positive outcomes through a reduction of foster care and expedited permanency for children. So the PCRP is a significant way, a change in the way that we contract for legal services. So rather than paying on a per case basis and not monitoring outcomes and quality, what we do in that program is we contract for a workload. So the lawyers are independent contractors, but you can think about more like doing a job. And we have specific contract obligations that lay the foundation for improved legal representation. The program basically stabilizes the attorneys so that they're able to focus on quality of work and results on behalf of their clients rather than balancing this huge caseload, running around all the time and trying to make ends meet. So, for example, in our contract, we have requirements about how attorneys are expected to spend their time. And they're expected to spend a third of their time in client contact, a third of their time in court and meetings, and a third of their time preparing for a case. And when you're balancing a huge caseload, that just doesn't happen. You don't have the time to do legal research like you would like. You don't have the time to meet with clients like you would like. The program also includes a caseload limit, and this is the only place in the public defense system where we have that. And it allows attorneys the time to provide quality work. High caseloads are problematic in many ways. They prevent attorneys from spending adequate time with clients and attending to work outside the courtroom. And where caseloads are excessively high, cases are actually delayed because lawyers aren't available for court hearings. And I practiced in Multnomah County, and I can say firsthand, there would be times when we would have a 15-minute hearing in front of the court just to check in about the status of something, and then a 15-minute proceeding about scheduling, right? Because there are so many people involved. And when people are scheduled out to the max, cases get delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. Attorneys in this program have access to case managers, social service professionals who serve as part of the legal team and work on the most complex cases. And case managers are really a strategic and treasured resource by the lawyers. And the strength there is that they provide confidential assistance to individual clients to help overcome barriers for court that led to court involvement. And I was just recently having a conversation with a DHS program manager, and we were talking about this because there's a question, you know, is the work of the case manager something that DHS could do or should do? And the truth of the matter is it's at this point, with the system being burdened in the way it is, DHS is thankful, I think, at least in the counties that I've worked with them, that there are case managers available. And they talk specifically about sort of when a case opens, a parent has significant mistrust, right? I mean, the agency, the state, has come in and often removed their child. And so at the very beginning of a case, they have significant mistrust. And a case manager works with them individually to help overcome these barriers that led to court involvement. And unlike DHS caseworkers, case managers focus only on the needs of a particular client and are able to maintain a confidential relationship with that client that gives the client a place to start and some trust in the system. The program is evidence-based. It's closely modeled on the program that I talked about in Washington State that has been independently evaluated, I think, 6 times now, and shown to consistently deliver better outcomes. And the program has an accountability component, me, the manager, oversight by an attorney manager. So this slide sort of highlights notable observations over the past 3 years of the program. Since the program started, we've been tracking the same data elements of publicly available DHS data. And what we've seen are some consistent trends since the program started. And I want to point out, be absolutely clear, that these are our observations only. You know, I'm not a statistician. This isn't causation-based data. But I'm going to talk quickly about the most important findings over the next couple of slides. So in this program, the population of children in foster care is declining, and differently, right, than the statewide average. Through the life of the program, the number of children in care statewide has actually increased by about 1.7% per year. Well, it's decreased by about 8.7% per year in the PCRP counties. And I've talked to several of you about this, and the question you always ask is, what does this mean in terms of dollars in children? You know, if you look at the average annual decrease and you apply it to the county's foster care population for the length of the program, I conservatively estimate it's about 130 fewer children in foster care. The most recent statistic I could find on the cost of foster care says basic family care is about $30,000 a year, and that's sort of the basic cost that wouldn't include, like, the court cost or special needs. And you can multiply that cost times the median length of stay, which is right now 18 months, and you can realize that foster care is a very expensive intervention. In the PCRP counties, children are reunified by families more quickly. The time to reunification in the PCRP counties has consistently decreased throughout the program by about 2 months per year, and currently in the PCRP counties, the average time to reunification is 7 months. Conversely, across the state, the number's been about 12 months, and it's still about 12 months. And I think it's important when you're thinking about reunification to think about whether that reunification is permanent or safe, right? And so I think these metrics need to be tracked in parallel, which is whether kids come back into the system once they're reunified with their families. And in the PCRP counties, the reentry rate is lower than the statewide rate and has been consistently. So this slide looks at the percentage of children achieving permanency within 24 months. And before the PCRP began, all of the counties in the program, so there's three, Lynn, Yanhill, and Columbia, they had rates below the statewide average. The rates continued to grow in the PCRP counties, and such that they now exceed the statewide average. So currently, 77% of children achieve permanency in 24 months in the PCRP counties, compared to 66% across the state. And this would be the one slide that is not related to DHS data, but rather related to our own. And our data shows that parents and children are receiving better legal representation. Attorneys are consistently present at shelter hearings, which is the first hearing that occurs right at the beginning of a case, right? Usually 24 hours, within 24 hours of a child being removed from their home. Before the program, neither parents nor children consistently had lawyers at this important hearing, where a visitation plan is developed, where allegations against the parents are raised for the first time. In addition, PCRP lawyers are expected to attend DHS case planning meetings. And again, this is really important because when you're dealing with children and families, the court system is not always the best place to be. You want to get people together and try to collaborate where you can to achieve better results. So it's important that the lawyers are present at these meetings. Furthermore, lawyers are expected to spend a significant amount of time with clients, including with child clients. During the previous year, the 22 attorneys in the program spent an average of 28% of their time with clients. So, before I discuss next steps...
Sorry, Representative
Mayfield. I just go back one slide.
Sure, of course. Oh, okay.
And then look at the bottom.
There you go. Yes.
97% client satisfaction rate. There is no attorney firm or any attorney that ever achieves 97%. I highly am skeptical of this thing, and I know it's not accurate. But go ahead and continue.
Co-chair,
that's why I'm a doctor and not a lawyer, because we do.
Co-chair Steiner Hayward, I will acknowledge that the way that we do the client satisfaction surveys is we actually work really hard right when a case closes to reach out to that client. A lot of time, and so it's self-selecting. So we call them, right? And we say, hey, are you willing to talk to us? And so truthfully, the vast majority are happy, right? Those are the ones willing to talk. And there is a small subset that is quite unhappy and actually often have valid complaints that I need to run down and follow up on. And so I appreciate I appreciate the vocal response that we do get. And it's interesting because, you know, this...
They should get on Yelp, you know?
They should.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, this idea of client satisfaction, although normal to in the medical field and normal in the private legal field, is new in public defense and is really met with a bit of resistance and barrier. So, you know, I'm glad that we're doing this outreach and trying to learn from it. So
it met with resistance in the other professions too. We started with it, and the fact that it's a metric has historically made people in medicine very anxious. I think people are understanding now that when patients are satisfied, the chances of them complying with their agreed upon course of action is much higher. And the chance of them returning for follow-up is higher and engaging as partners. And I think the same thing is true for legal representation. So ultimately, outcomes are better all around when patients or clients are satisfied with the care, that the help they're getting.
It wraps back into this concept of procedural justice. So before I discuss next steps, I'd like to mention the Governor's Task Force on Legal Representation and Childhood Dependency. This three-branch task force was asked to evaluate the dependency system and make recommendations on how to improve the system through legal representation. After nearly a year's worth of work, the task force issued a report and recommended expansion statewide of the parent-child representation program because, and this was a year and a half ago, but because even then there was promising data that looked at cost effectiveness and improved outcomes. That task force also recommended full legal representation for DHS by DOJ and enhanced judicial resources. Last session, the legislature directed full legal representation for DHS. And while there is no dispute that consistent representation of the agency from start to finish in a case is needed, parallel funding for parent and children, representation of parents and children, wasn't provided. I think the next steps for the program are to continue to manage, monitor, and improve the existing program while seeking to expand into new counties. And We're looking to expand incrementally into a couple of additional counties. And in addition to improving legal representation in those counties, this will help us qualify for a free University of Chicago grant-funded study that would, from the outside, evaluate the effectiveness of our program. And what's really, we're a finalist for this program, but the researchers need some more data points outside of the existing three counties. And what's really interesting about this study is it would be directed by Mark Courtney, who's the same person that did the evaluation in Washington State and a couple other places, and so he's an expert in this kind of work.
Can I just say something about that? We are a state that actually is ranked one of the highest in the nation for using evidence-based policy, right? And we're very careful about this kind of thing. We don't want to spend money on something that we aren't pretty confident is really going to make a difference in the lives of Oregonians and ultimately save us money, improve the lives of our residents and save us money. And this opportunity, Ms. Miller and I have talked about this more, Mr. Borg, Mr. Miller and I, I've talked about this more offline, and this is an extraordinary opportunity for our state to have a highly respected external person come in and evaluate, so that by the time we get around to looking at the budget toward the end of the 2019 session, we will have a clearer sense of, from an external, impartial, experienced researcher, about whether we really are making a difference, and we will be able to quantify both the positive effects on children and families, and the cost savings involved with this. And that's pretty substantive. It's a substantive opportunity. It's one of the reasons I thought it was important for this committee to hear about this, because although I'm the only one who serves on public safety here, you all have colleagues who serve there too, and expressing your interest in this possibility, if you agree that this is an important step forward, will help encourage them to authorize additional funding, which obviously I'm strongly in support of.
Thank you. I think one thing that's interesting about the study in Washington State is that they were able to quantify what the program cost and then what that program saved to the state. And there's the same challenge there in terms of sort of siloing and how that looks. But you know, what that evaluation found is that the program actually saved, and this was in 2011 and 12, that the program actually saved $7.5 million to the state, right? And when you pay for this, so the program paid for itself, plus was linked to these, associated with or correlated to these improved outcomes.
And it's even harder to track, frankly, the cost savings associated with reducing trauma to children and the lifelong implications of that trauma, getting them back together with their families quickly in ways that are safe for them, we know has a positive impact on school performance, on long-term health, on all sorts of things. Those are very hard to quantify, but we know that they're real.
In closing, I just, you know, want to again emphasize that lawyers for parents and children are an essential piece of the dependency system and of the larger child welfare system. And the dependency system cannot function well unless it's understood and administered as a comprehensive whole, not a set of disconnected components. And Justice Brewer, who has been a leader in efforts to improve the juvenile court, said that investments or changes to the dependency system should be premised on two things. First, that there must be shared ownership of child welfare outcomes across the branches and throughout the system. And second, that there must be shared accountability for the protection of the rights of Oregon's children and families. And I think this program attempts to do just that. Using data as a guide, the program shows that it is possible to both protect the legal rights of parents and children while contributing to positive outcomes for Oregon's families. And my hope is that the legislature continues to invest in this program. Thank you very much for your interest in this important issue and for your continued commitment to strengthening Oregon's families.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you.
I think we lose sight, too, that the savings of $7.5 million, the future savings of taking care of our children, are immense.
Yeah.
I have a constituent that has a child in juvenile detention, but it took almost 2 months to get a psychiatrist to visit that child, had to come from Portland. So there are things we could help in the system, because nothing could happen with moving them out without the psychiatrist report. So we need to work at speeding up, and your program for attorneys is great. So thank you very much. And any help you can do on that problem that I did view would be deeply appreciated.
Chair Steiner-Hayward and Representative DeBoer, to that point, my previous life at Metropolitan Public Defenders, one of the things we recognize that problem, regional delivery of services, especially mental health services, is a huge challenge that my current agency faces for that very reason that you were talking about. But one of the things that's been really helpful, again, going to this collaborative nature of solving problems and not looking at old silos on how to do it, but try to get together, is how the crisis over the state hospital really fomented change in Multnomah County on doing mental health evaluations, and that's showing a lot of promise in terms of the speed of delivery of that, the rethinking, do we really need a full-on evaluation or do we need a more specific evaluation to answer a question for a judge now? And I think that we're seeing changes, but that's coming about because, as Senator Steiner-Hayward mentioned, we've got to be collaborative. You know, one thing I just want to echo on that I saw as a provider, the providers are doing this. It is coming. The questions were already being asked when I was involved with Justice Reinvestment in Multnomah County, is things like, why should we put this person in inpatient treatment until their housing is stabilized? Because the research says they're not going to be successful in inpatient treatment unless their housing is stabilized. We're going to be wasting that money. And so it's really, we have to be collaborative in order to be successful on this and look for different solutions and not just say, well, what did we do, you know, 15 years ago?
Just one follow-up.
Please.
And I want to issue my support for the CASA program. I think it's one of the best things I've seen for the children's benefit. Thank you.
And I, in response, Co-Chairs Rayfield and Senator Hayward, Senator DeBoer, I should have mentioned that within the recommendations of the Governor's Task Force report, there was a recommendation for additional funding for CASA. Initially for legal representation. I believe that CASA at this point has changed that to just seeking additional funding to expand their program, recognizing the need for more CASAs. So I appreciate that comment.
Representative Rayfield, Representative Buehler, Representative Alonzo Leon, and then Senator Gelser.
Okay.
Yeah, just really quickly, I just wanted to mention that as we talk about this, you know, legal representation is a good check on and balance in the system. It is not a, you know, there's a lot of reasons why some of the results can occur, and this is, you know, the check and balance system is very important, but I also think we need to really make sure that this doesn't detract away from the work we still need to do in child welfare. You know, there are frontline workers that are doing the work in child welfare. We'll spend an inordinate amount of time preparing for these, what they are very contested case hearings, and in many other situations. And when they're doing that, and they're spending 75%, 80% of their work doing that, which is necessary, it's important to do that, right? They are not doing the work that actually really will get the results, which is providing the social work so they can reunify families, right? And then we wonder why they can't do their jobs. Right, and so this is a multi-layered thing, and so I just wanted to make sure that we always keep in mind the frontline workers that are doing this job and that are stressed on resources and can't do the things, the social work that's really necessary. But I also want to acknowledge that having a check on the system to be able to say, hey, are they doing the work, is really important too. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, tug and pull there. And then I've also encouraged them to reach out to a lot of the frontline workers and say, how can we make this system better so that way frontline workers actually can do that work more? How can we make this entire system more efficiently? So I think that's really important, as well as I think it should be reaching out to some of the end user clients as well as you're doing. What I can say in some of the conversations I've had, it is not all rosy, you know, and there's ways that can be improved upon as well.
And I would say that I think that our work, I would completely agree with everything you've said, and I know Ms. Miller and Mr. Borg mm-hmm. do as well. One of the things we tried to do, one of the reasons we chose to move forward with funding for the caseworker representation through DOJ last year was for exactly this reason, that the caseworkers were having to do a lot of work that was really more appropriate for attorneys to be doing. And we want to develop a cadre of experienced DOJ attorneys who can do that piece of it, can help with the preparation. It's necessary but not sufficient, and I get all that, but I'm just saying that it's part of an integrated system.
Even
really
with
important.
Representation, just know that for this committee and in this area, even with representation, a significant chunk of their time is spent.
Oh, I don't disagree. Court, so, I'm just saying that we're trying to facilitate. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, just to follow up on Senator DeBoer and Representative Rayfield. You know, obviously the child welfare agency is understaffed and has a lot of operational challenges, as the recent audit outlined, 24 recommendations in terms of lack of appropriate resources, data management, just an incredible need for more caseworkers. And actually, a finding of the task force, one of its key findings with regards to obstacles to quality representation, is along the same lines. And I'll quote, you know, although all children and parents receive attorneys, high caseloads and the inability to access social service experts sometimes stand in the way of high quality representation. So I'll ask, what are we doing to solve this problem? A problem that's been recognized in this state for almost a decade. We've had multiple reports, and it's clear that the agency is severely under-resourced. And it's even affecting representation.
Representative Bueller, co-chairs, I don't know that it's appropriate for me to comment on what the Department of Human Services is doing, but I can tell you that the work that we're doing in the parent-child representation program, I really think is the direction that we need to be going in, because some of the issues that Representative Rayfield raised about not being able to provide services because preparing for court, those types of things, by having lawyers that are integrated at the beginning of these cases, they settle in a better way. And so in Yamhill County, for example, before this program started, there were a significant number of TPR cases, termination of parental rights cases. As a result of this program, and Judge Collins submitted a letter to this effect, there are very few now. And that is because at the beginning of the case, people are working together and cases result in the right conclusion, the right outcome. And I think that's a big piece of it, is resourcing people in a way that are able to spend time doing the work.
Representative Lonsalio.
Thank you, Chair. My question is more programming, because I'm really fascinated by all that. Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of support the parents are receiving in the PCRP? I think about more in preparing parents on how to parent when children have been incarcerated and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Representative Alonzo Leon, Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Rayfield, that's a great question. So I think you're probably referring mostly to the work of our case managers, who are the social service workers that work on some of these cases. And they are a highly experienced group. We have former DHS workers, we have former parole and probation officers, former CASA directors, all that do this work. And, you know, they sort of assess the needs of the particular parent, but some of the things that they do are they will take the time to walk through visitation notes that the agency provides, and they'll say, hey, you know, I noticed here that, you know, you may have been on your phone when your child was asking you a question. This is an opportunity to learn about how to parent more appropriately. So they do hands-on engagement in that way. And the other thing that they do is they advocate for services that are a bit outside the box. So, for example, it might be appropriate for some parents, particularly some with sort of cognitive challenges, to receive sort of hands-on parent training, right? But that's valuable. Not everybody's is able to receive that service. It's more expensive. And so they do advocacy to try to make sure that parents receive the services that they need. So I think it's a combination of both doing hands-on work where they can, as well as making sure that the parents are able, you know, pushing for using those valuable resources in a way that makes the most sense for this particular client.
Senator Kelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been so pleased that this has been in my community for a while. I think it's made a real difference. And the challenge that we have here on the Making It Better, when we talk about where do you put the investment, one of the pushbacks I've heard to this program or to the ongoing conversation we're having about representation for caseworkers when they're in these hearings is that the money would be better spent someplace else in the child welfare system, and that we don't want to spend money on a bunch of attorneys. But these attorneys make an enormous difference, even though they are outside the agency. They are not employed by the agency. This is not an agency expense, but it is incredibly important to the work that the agency does. For example, one of the key things that I have gotten to see in Linn County, and not just when it's been set up as a day for me to go in, but sitting in case meetings and other kind of collaborative team meetings, the difference it makes when a child has an attorney that they know. And more importantly, the attorney knows the child, knows the child's case history, knows what the child's overall needs are, knows what the child's desires and wishes are. that allows them to actually advocate for what it is that that child needs, as opposed to other places, not because anybody doesn't care about the kids that they're serving, but if they don't have the time and they're just picking up the case of the day, they're going to have a chance to peruse the file before they go in and not really understand the full humanity and background of this child. In Linn County, these attorneys are visiting with the kids where they're at. They're asking the kids what they need and where they're at. When we went through the Give Us This Day situation several years ago, I know the governor asked, where were the attorneys? And we went back and checked with the kids, where were your attorneys? They didn't know their attorneys' names. Now, at any time they were in a hearing, there was an attorney maybe for them, but if you don't know who your attorney is, you don't know how to get a hold of them, it doesn't do you very good. Second, the work of the caseworkers is really important for the parents as well, because if you feel like you're in an adversarial position with the department, it is very difficult to hear them say, did you go to your drug treatment today? Or let's work on your parenting skills with your child. When your attorney who is advocating for you, or the social worker that is talking to you, or the social worker that comes out and encourages you and supports you, that yes, you can get through the door of that room. And just if you could indulge me for one more second, there was this really powerful case that we got to see when we were there, where the parent, at the time that the child had been removed, was profoundly mentally ill. So, and she was so deep in her illness that she needed a guardian ad litem. What I understand from the case is when she first went in, someone had to physically go to her home to help her leave her house, get dressed, and have the confidence to walk into that courtroom. The ability to do that led to a woman that stood there in court that day. I never would have guessed that had been her history, and she was making real progress to reunification with her child. And those are the places where reunification needs to happen. It's what the child wanted as well. It wasn't happening yet, but without this program, that never, ever, ever could have happened. And that goes to real change to the agency, I think. So I am just such a huge supporter of this, and of good judges. Good judges that really focus on the families and the needs. Judge Murphy in Linn County, who's unfortunately retiring, I think has really set the bar for how to handle dependency cases.
Good judges are important. Yes.
Okay, we need to move on because we have another presentation. Thank you both very, very much for your hard work, for your clear presentation, and for bringing this to keep us in the loop on all this. We're going to be moving into a presentation on the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I want to welcome the latest in my series of job shadows, Dr. Amelia Baker's in the back room. I have family medicine residents job shadowing me a day a week this year, and I'm very excited to have her with them. It's part of their leadership curriculum. Representative Rayfield, can I have a gavel over to you for 1 second? I just need to step out for a sec. Thank you. Can we get started on this one? Thanks.
Members of the committee, during this 2017 session, when you approved the budget for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Public Guardian Program, there were some adjustments made in the budget, and some money was set aside in a special purpose appropriation with the understanding the agency would do some work on the program and come back and report to you on what was happening and some recommendations for moving forward. They came in January and provided a report. That was a very brief and kind of got caught off at the end of the meeting. So we asked them to come back and kind of give you that update again so you have some time to ask questions if you want to. And when I sent the materials yesterday, I did provide a link to the report that they provided back in January, which was pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fred Steele. I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman and the Agency Director for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and here today in that Agency Director role for our three programs that we have in our office, one of which is the Public Guardian Program. I want to thank you for having us back. It was short in January, but personally, I'm just very excited for us to have the opportunity to describe to you, a little more detail about where we're at with the State Public Guardian Program. As someone I had served on the legislatively created Public Guardian Conservator Task Force for two of its 4 years when it was formed between 2009 and 2013, I'm personally very excited with where the program is currently and with the leadership and where we're going and moving forward with the program and serving vulnerable Oregonians. With me today is our state public guardian, Chris Rosin, who a number of you were here. I think all of you actually were here in January, and we've had an opportunity to meet many of you here in the last month at some point, much of that in the last week or so. Also with us is Rebecca Fetter. She is our agency deputy director and effectively our COO and CFO. She is our financial and operations expert. But even more so, during the transition of time between the prior leadership of the Public Guardian Program and when Mr. Rosin was appointed as the State Public Guardian in September, there was about a five-month period there where Ms. Fetters was doing an enormous amount of work, really kind of stabilizing the program from the concerns of what were even highlighted to some degree here with this committee and some of the members last session, but that we knew about internally as well. She did some significant work in stabilizing and reducing overutilization of Department of Justice and reducing those costs, really pushing to create some policies and procedures that weren't quite in place yet, building that foundation for a program, and even more so, starting with finalizing a contract with an important partner for our program, the Senior Citizens Council of Clackamas County. And so that was an enormous amount of work that she was doing in that transition period to stabilize the program. And then in step Mr. Rosin, who's really been running with program development and again, has this program really built for the future, and for us today and what we're here for here in February is hopefully to be able to get that $200,000 that was put away in a special purpose appropriation, hoping for reinvestment into the program. He'll be able to talk about some of that exceptional work that he's doing and has been doing an enormous amount of work since September in building partnerships and really building a foundation for a program that maximizes the resources that are provided to it from this committee and your colleagues. And for me, looking at it as kind of really doing it in the Oregon way, building a system of partners to deliver services through that network of system partners. So with that, I'll keep my comments to that and turn it over to Mr. Rosin for more details of where we're at.
Thank you, Mr. Steele, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Rayfield, members of the committee. I am Chris Rosin, the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator. Thank you for the introduction. So really, what I have attempted to do and what was really not being done with the program prior to my taking over was developing a network of partners to support public guardianship in Oregon. The model before was very much insular, to go it alone, to take on the system from the public guardian's office, and it was really focused on a client-centered mindset, to be as vigorous of an advocate for the clients as possible, but there was a sort of a lack of engagement with all of the system partners that would be needed to really get those clients the services that they need in a quality manner. The Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator Program cannot go it alone. We cannot be insular, not only in getting the access to the clients that really need our services, those most vulnerable, most at-risk adults in Oregon, but once we do have access to them, once we have become their guardians, it's those same partners that we are dependent on to provide the services that they need to support them so that they can be as independent and have the best quality of life that they possibly can. So it really is a program that cannot work on its own. It really needs to have the partnership with other state programs, the Aging and People with Disabilities, Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Developmental Disability Services, and then sub-programs within those, like the Oregon Money Management Program, the state hospital itself. There's a number of programs that we're working with that we've opened up to. And beyond that, beyond the state programs, we also need to work with the Guardian and Conservators Association of Oregon, which is the trade group for the professional guardians that practice here. We need to work with the independent programs that are out there, the nonprofits that are capable of providing some level of public guardianship services or services on behalf of the public guardian. And that's really what we've done since things have turned around last April. So I did want to put in one, part of what we've done to those partnerships is the high-risk teams. That's really where it started. That was actually my idea from the very beginning. Prior to moving into the Oregon Public Guardian Conservator role, I was one of the first two deputies with the program and been there since the program has had staff. The very first month that I was there was when I came up with this idea for these high-risk teams and presented it to the current Public Guardian. We've developed five high-risk teams covering seven counties. I have plans to develop one or to convert one more of the current existing ones to cover two additional counties so we can get up to nine counties in Oregon covered. But these are a collaborative group of all of the local programs, nonprofits, basically all the entities that have direct contact with the most vulnerable, most at-risk, most underserved individuals. These can be homeless outreach programs. These are hospitals. These are adult protective service agencies. These are just anyone. These are that has that contact. So this is their access point to us. But really what those teams do is they evaluate less restrictive alternatives first. We only pursue guardianship when there is absolutely no other option. We only pursue public guardianship when there is no other option for less restrictive alternatives or for some other guardian, be that a responsible family or friend that is able to serve in that role, or a professional fiduciary if there's funds, or a nonprofit that exists that does that kind of work in a community. We work to support that, but we only take the cases where there's just no other way to get the person safe. Okay, so as far as growth in current caseload with current resources, the slide currently that you're looking at shows where we expect to be. And to be honest with you, this was a slide that we created about 2 months ago for the last presentation, and since that time, it's become a bit out of date. We have taken on far more cases. We have gotten far more intakes and assessments going currently than we expected at this point, based on, and really what that has to do with is the outreach that we put out to all of these programs in the last 6 to 9 months, saying we're open for business, we are taking the cases that need to be taken. There's been overwhelming response of cases getting referred to us, and now we are overwhelmed with what we're dealing with there. But I do not expect that it will take all the way until February 2019 till we are full at absolute full capacity. Full capacity for the program with current resources is approximately 50 to 54 cases. I have two deputies and one administrative specialist for my entire program in addition to myself. Both deputies can handle about approximately 20 cases. That is the National Guardianship Association model practice standard for what a guardian can do, and what we found with the types of cases that we take on. They're the most difficult. They're the most time consuming. These are the people that are the most unstable, that have the most behavioral issues, that have the highest likelihood of the placement that they're in not working out, needing to transfer repeatedly until we can find that stable long-term option for this person. But the total there in February 19 is at least we're expecting to be at 54 cases. That would be our entire internal caseload, in addition to completely filling up the contract that we have with Senior Citizens Council of Clackamas County. As a note on that, with the contract with Senior Citizens Council, it's not appropriate for every case. One major restriction is that it can only be within an hour, up to an hour and a half from Oregon City, which is where that program is centered out of. So if the person is located beyond that, it's not a case that we can transfer. Additionally, there are some highly complex issues that we are dealing with some of the clients that we have. And if we're thinking that they're going to need to move soon, or that they're placement might become unstable and they might be bouncing around between psychiatric hospitals and their placement, it's not something that we want to put on this small Clackamas County-based nonprofit, especially if there's some indication that person might not stay within that hour and a half range of their office. Currently, we have transferred four cases to them, but I only have one additional case that we are currently prepping. None of the other cases managed by the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator Program would be appropriate or within that driving distance for them. So even though full capacity may be 54, if we don't have the right types of cases in the right place, it's actually lower than that. It's just our internal capacity plus what can be given to them, which at this point would be about 45. Okay. So we have achieved significant cost savings over the previous way that the program was being operated. All legal resources were going directly through the Department of Justice, with them drafting and creating every single legal document that was filed on behalf of the program, from petitions to court reports. Very, very expensive way to do business. There is state law that requires any state of Oregon agency to be represented by Department of Justice, and so it looked to be this just had to be the way things were done. However, in that time after the public guardian, the previous public guardian left, through discussions with myself and Ms. Fetters, what we found is that there actually are other options for doing this if you're willing to be creative. One of the quirks of the guardianship petitioning process is that the person who is the proposed guardian does not have to be the petitioner. The petitioner can be anyone who's concerned about that person's safety and has information that would support the finding of incapacity and the need for guardianship. And so what we've done is we've reached out to these partners that we're building, and we've asked that, okay, well, you've got this client who is a tremendous burden on your resources and you've been able to inadequately help protect. We have the ability to protect them, but we don't have the resources to file the legal proceedings in every case. And so we found a number of partners that are willing to put up the money for the upfront legal costs, to contract with a local attorney in Deschutes County. The Deschutes County Council has actually agreed to file a petition on our behalf in an upcoming case. And so it won't require a private individual. It just requires a county attorney program that already exists to file a petition, which we will be helping them with. Beyond that, where we haven't been able to find a partner willing to do that, I myself am an attorney. It was something that was always considered with the program prior to my taking over, but I'm able to draft petitions. I certainly have all of the information through our assessment process for these clients, and when I draft the petition and then provide it to Department of Justice for final legal review, it's a much less costly way to do business. And so in those cases where we still are required to use Department of Justice, we've dramatically reduced the cost by having our own program draft the legal paperwork before sending it over. We're doing that for notices of placements, annual guarding reports, a number of different legal documents that need to be filed. But at this point, we have reduced the monthly average DOJ billing from $11,877 to $24,16, and that's with the entire time we've been growing our caseload. So we went from a very few number of cases where we were paying for that high amount to we're now currently at 26 cases, and we've reduced by approximately 75-80% of Department of Justice costs. I do not anticipate that there's any way to get them lower than we currently are, and actually I anticipate them to go up some, even though we were not using Department of Justice for the initial billing or the initial petition filing. There still is a role that they need to do to represent us, because there are certain things in the process where the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator is doing something or is represented, so that petitioning attorney can't fill that role. We're finding that on average it's costing about $1,000 per case to have Department of Justice just do those small things that they need to do, principally around notice of placement, notice of representation, those sorts of things. But as we take on new cases, I'm anticipating filing. I've given approval on four or five new cases that private attorneys will be filing. If those all get filed within a month, the Department of Justice rates it could cost us $5,000, even if they don't file a single petition for us. So I anticipate that will stabilize, possibly go up some as we really start getting through this influx of intakes that we've been dealing with. But we are doing it as absolutely financially responsibly as possible with the resources that we have. The next thing that I want to talk to you about is really what is the real game-changing idea that I've had, and that is that we can use volunteer guardians to support the work of the public guardian program. This was something that had been analyzed before and always thought to be something that wasn't advisable or something that simply couldn't be accomplished. But after some of the work that we did with setting up a contract for contracted services, it really provided a model for what we came up with for volunteer public guardians. Really on the front end, and what the work that we're doing right now is designing the training. These individuals will have incredible responsibility and they will have incredible power over an individual person that they make the decisions for. That person no longer will have the legal right to make their own decisions, and this volunteer guardian will step into their place. I do not take that lightly. I do not take handing off my responsibility lightly at all. And so I need to ensure that anyone that I give that responsibility to is fully prepared and fully knowledgeable and understands that the way that the system works, what their role as a volunteer public guardian is. And so what we're looking at is a 30 to 40 hour training program, bringing in many of these different partners to actually provide pieces of the training. I would like to have aging and people with disabilities come in and provide a training to prospective guardians about how their service delivery system works, how to access those services, how if you feel your client is not getting the services that they need, how you do a redetermination, all of the sorts of things, because there are, these are complicated systems. And depending on what this person's actual disability and needs are, these services can vary widely even within a single system, even within APD, if you have someone who is pretty much just physically disabled or significantly cognitively impaired from dementia, they may require very different services than someone who has physical disabilities but has a primary mental health issue that's causing their incapacity. And so guardians, volunteer guardians, really need to know how this complicated system works, and that's what we're developing right now. It will involve shadowing and ongoing mentorship by program deputies to support the work of the volunteers. These cases are so complex and they're so difficult, I can't just give guardianship authority to a volunteer and just hope that they go do their best. The program will need to continue to support them if they're going to do quality work on behalf of the people that we serve. Yes.
Yeah, and I have to take off in about 3 minutes, but I just want to say publicly, especially to the group, is like we put you, both of us, put you through the ringer last session. We cut the budget. We put money aside, right? And we encourage you to think creatively about how to deliver these services in a more cost-efficient way. And I think you guys have done a wonderful job, especially, I have to come back in just a week, because we were, pretty direct during the session. So I just wanted to say, publicly, I think you guys have done a wonderful job with the way this is going, and I would encourage more of this type of thinking. So,
yeah.
Well done.
I was going to say that at the end, but you beat me to it. I know you have to leave. So consider it set. I completely agree with Representative Bueller. I think the turnaround in a very short period of time.
I got an upgrade.
You got an upgrade?
Representative Bueller.
Bueller. Sorry. I'm so sorry. I was thinking about Representative Bueller's
facial hair. I've,
it's very confusing. I apologize. I'm not quite my best this morning. Representative Rayfield and I completely agree. It's really remarkable what you've managed to accomplish in a very short period of time, and this kind of thinking is exactly what we were hoping you would do. So keep going, but know that
Chairs, thank you.
We're impressed.
Thank you, co-chairs. Yeah, no. So in addition, what I really need to do with this program is to make sure that the primary interest, the primary focus is on the safety and interests of the protected people that we're serving. There is a recognition that certain cases will never be appropriate for transfer, and when we are transferring a case, it really needs to be in a way that benefits that person. I've developed my thoughts on how that's going to work, and basically what I'm looking at is that those volunteers for the first 6 months or so of service would only be serving in a case management role without decisional authority. This will give us the time and ability to review the work that they do under the guidance and actual authority of the deputy that's serving on the case. It will provide some assistance to the deputies as their caseloads grow. If they have certain number of cases that volunteers are actively doing the case management on, it will free up time for their more difficult cases, these cases that I'm talking about that can never be transferred. And really what it'll allow for is sort of a seamless transition. It'll allow the client to get to know that person to make sure that there aren't going to be any sort of conflicts or any sorts of issues there. And I'll be thoughtful before I actually transfer that authority, and it'll only be after that 6 month time and shown that it's working in the way that it should. If there's any problems with any of these cases, the cases will always stay, the appointed, court-appointed guardian will always be the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator. And what this will allow me to do is if there do become problems on any of these cases, I'm never going to put one of my clients at risk because I need to support a volunteer on this. I will always be able to pull the case back, to pull it back within in-house program deputies and stabilize the case and whatever needs to happen. I'm only going to be, essentially these volunteer guardians will be on somewhat of a short leash, but they will have full decisional authority over the people. And so I think that's the right balance to strike as far as protection of individuals and with cost efficiency, with trying to find a creative ways to deliver services.
Co-chair, can I get a time check? I'm trying to remember if we have till 9:45 or till 10. I just want to make sure we're respectful of everybody's time.
The time of this committee is theoretically 9:45.
Yeah.
We tend to assume we've talked to our members about planning on staying till 5 of, but if people need to leave, do people need
to? I have to go at 9:45. Mm-hmm.
You have to go at 9:45? Okay. Well, if we can, let's target 9:50.
6 minutes.
I'll hurry up.
Rock and roll. Okay. I thought we had everybody.
And so as far as the benefits, I mean, obviously this increases our capacity and it increases it in a way where the services that are being provided are of absolute quality, and that really goes on the training and support that we provide to these professional fiduciaries. It really does benefit professional fiduciaries that would be interested in working with us. They do have ongoing continuing education requirements to maintain their guardianship certification. And it would allow them, because the practice before there was a public guardian is that there was pro bono work done by some professional guardians. However, these were generally lifetime appointments. They would never receive any payment on, and they were just out there on an island without support from the system, often battling against the system to get the services for these people. And so what the pro bono program is, it would allow professional fiduciaries who want to do give back, to want to do some nonprofit work, to do it in a way that is safe, that is supported, and is not a lifetime appointment where they're saddled with this case. Even if they are, you know, served on it for 20 years and want to retire, they wouldn't be able to do so if it under the old system, where we're offering them that ability to do it safely and in a structured, supported way. And with new professional fiduciaries, you know, there's individual, it would be an ability for people to have a volunteer opportunity like none other. You would be the absolute person for some other highly vulnerable, you know, a highly dependent person who really needs you to do that, and you would have the ability to make their life better. And so I think the opportunity that we'd be giving for people that are non-professionals that just want to do this, that would be qualified to do this, is pretty exceptional. And anyone that would be a new professional fiduciary, there's actually increased education credits that are required to get your certification these days, and so we would be able to support and allow for there to be more professional fiduciaries in Oregon.
Okay. All right. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Fetters. I am the Deputy Director at the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. And in that role, I work extensively with our budget, with contracts and procurement, and with staff and position management. And I think that these are all areas that are going to have some impact on kind of the next steps and future growth of the Oregon Public Guardian Program. I do not normally talk as fast as Chris, but I'm going to try. I just want to hit on a couple of things that I think that we need to be taking into consideration as we contemplate what the next steps of the program are and the growth of the program. We really would like to be able to expand into parts of the state that historically have not been served by guardianship services, and where we know that that need exists. So that is a kind of a first priority of ours. We always want to be balancing program growth and capacity with the responsible delivery of guardianship services. So we never want to compromise the health or safety of a protected person for whom we're appointed in an effort to just grow the program very quickly. So we're always mindful of that. We want to, as Chris has said, really maximize the use of volunteers in the program. We're co-housed with the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, which has been doing just that for decades. And we think that we can really learn from some of their practices, their best practices, and use some of those in the development and ongoing maintenance of the OPG volunteer program. And we are always wanting to balance cost efficiency of the program with risk management. And that's something I want to talk about just a little bit more, because I think it is an area where we're starting to encounter some challenges and that we need to be mindful of as we're contemplating how we're going to move forward. We're very committed to the contract model of service delivery. We've entered into a contract in Clackamas County, and I think that we believe that it's going well and is a successful way to deliver services. We would like to be able to put similar contracts in place in other parts of the state, and we would like to be able to contract for other elements of service delivery like case management. But what we are starting to run up against a little bit is not necessarily finding people who can deliver those services for us, but who can obtain the level of insurance and liability coverage that is necessary to execute a contract with the state. Because we're talking about contracting out a type of service where even the smallest error or omission on the part of the contractor could have a very serious outcome to a vulnerable individual. And so the you know, the insurance and liability requirements need to be commensurate with that and protect all parties. We've recently been talking to some potential contractors who have found that obtaining this level of coverage is, in some cases, really just not even possible for them to obtain through their carrier. And so as we think about how we're going to deliver services going forward, we just want to have that possibility in mind. We've put together two plans that we could see advancing all of the things that we've talked about here today. The first would involve the hiring of two deputy ombudsmen. As Chris has mentioned, there are currently two on staff, so this effectively doubles the ombudsman staff. Although those people would be state employees, they would be outstationed in rural or underserved portions of the state, which, again, we really feel the need to do. Having these staff in place would really allow for the maximum implementation and development of the volunteer vision that Chris has. What we know from the long-term care ombudsman program is to have a really vibrant volunteer base, you need a staff person available to those volunteers to train them, to mentor them, to support them, and to manage them. Otherwise, they feel not supported and kind of fade away. This would obviously overcome some of the barriers that we're having to entering into contracts. It would double our in-house program capacity from 40 protected persons to 80. And it also helps us operate more efficiently in terms of our existing travel. Right now, we have two Salem-based deputies that are needing to go to places like Ontario and Wallawa and Milton Freewater. And that comes at a cost, obviously a fiscal cost, but also a time efficiency cost. Our plan B would be kind of a hybrid, where we would propose hiring one deputy ombudsman to do those same things that were outlined in Plan A, although obviously only in one rural part of the state. So it would accomplish everything that we're looking for in Plan A, but at a slightly lesser level. It would allow us to contract with a guardianship provider that currently exists in Jackson County. That's the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services. And while that doesn't allow for expansion into a non-served part of the state, it does allow them to increase their capacity in a part of the state where we know the need does exist. They've been in operation for quite some time, but they have very limited caseload capacity. I think they're almost always at maximum capacity, and definitely that area would benefit from that increased capacity. And the last thing we would do with those funds would be to just for a short period of time contract with individuals to help us process our incoming referrals and assessments. As Chris mentioned, right now that duty falls to the two deputy ombudsmen, but we're also asking them to actually serve as guardian for the people that we're currently appointed on. Assessments can take anywhere from 5 to 20 hours, usually closer to 10. And that's just a very difficult balancing act. And so that, at this point in time, that's slowing our growth rate a little bit. I think if we could contract out that function, we could be processing those referrals more quickly and getting more people enrolled into the program. So that would be our plan under Plan B. And I'm over time, and I will stop now.
And if I could just make one final plea, I mean, what I feel that I've done is I have been as absolutely efficient and effective as I can with the resources that I've been given to develop this program and to roll out services. What I really need is I need more staff at this point. I cannot come anywhere close to meeting the unmet need for public guardianship services in Oregon with two deputy public guardians. I really can't come close to it with four, but it's twice what I can do right now. Everything that I'm building for the program centers around the deputies being at the core of it, having a strong core program that then supports the volunteers, that then supports the contracts. And it's just absolutely critical. With two deputies, if we could just back up a couple of slides to the map. Okay. I mean, really, I've taken a look at the map of Oregon. I've looked at what two deputies can do with the resources that I have, and really, I can divide Oregon into five regions. With five deputies, I could be an active presence taking on the absolute worst of the worst cases in every region of Oregon. With four, I can get to 80% of those regions. I can get to four out of the five. With only one extra deputy, then I would be only getting to three out of the five, and there'd be two large portions of the state that would continue to have very minimal Oregon public guardianship activity because we just simply don't have those resources. I'm trying to build everything else I can around these deputies. They will be the support for the volunteers. Every additional deputy that I get will bring in the ability to support more volunteers in more areas of the state. Without deputies in those rural areas in central, southern, or eastern Oregon, I can't have volunteers because there isn't that support for them that Rebecca was talking about, and I really can't. I can't put volunteers out there on an island without that sort of support. Right. So what I need is...
I'm going to interrupt you. We got it. We believe you. We understand you. We'll be setting up a separate meeting with Co-Chair Rayfield, Ms. Byerly, myself, and the two of you, some combination of all of you, at some point in the near future between now and the end of session. We understand, and I want to echo what Representative Rayfield said before he left. You've done remarkable work in a very short period of time. We want to help you be able to continue that work. So... thank you. Anything further before the committee this morning? Next week we meet.
On Monday we have a meeting, informational meeting. We've got Rebs of Alonzo and Leon's got a panel coming in to talk about health disparities. Mm-hmm. And we also have a presentation from the Department of Human Services on the eligibility transition and the integrated eligibility system project.
Great. So we will see you at 8:30 Monday morning. Thank you all. We're adjourned.